When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It was like my mom's financial advisor. And so she's like, you need to open an IRA. So I was like, okay, and just did that. And then I think, I just don't know what happened to it. So there's 30K in there. So I don't know
that's
if I keep
a little... That's not a little bit of money. And it's, are you sure it's not deductible? None of that is pre-tax? Hello, and welcome to Planancials Podcast, Future Rich. I am your host, Barbara Ginty, and I'm also a CFP, which is a certified financial planner. And I am here with my guest today, Anna. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself so our listeners know who you are, where you live, what you do, all of that jazz?
Yeah, that's great. So I'm Anna. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am 38, going to be 39 in a couple months, and I work in technology sales for a SaaS startup, and I have 2 young children. So I have a 5-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl, and I'm married.
Busy.
Yeah.
And you're married. Okay.
Yes.
And what does your spouse do?
Yeah, so my partner is in the food and beverage industry, so he works for a wine and... beverages.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I really don't know exactly what he does, but yeah.
And then how much do you make and how much does he make approximately?
Yeah, so we both have base and commission jobs. So okay. Currently my base is around 150K with 110 variable commission. My husband has like around 135K base with a variable commission around 30K.
Okay, 135 for his base and then 35 variable.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. And you had submitted that you wanted to talk about, do you want to tell our listeners?
Yeah, so I don't know if I'm having like a midlife crisis or, you know, since I'll be 40 next year, but I feel like financially, you know, I've been pretty good. I feel like I've been pretty good in terms of saving and understanding where the money's coming and going. My husband, you know, in his 20s didn't save that aggressively. So I feel like we've been playing catch up. But I'm not too happy in my current job. And okay. I've been doing tech sales for over 13, 14 years. And so I'm wanting to get a more comprehensive understanding of like where we are financially and is there potentially an opportunity to make a shift as I'm entering like my 40s of, you know, could I take a lower paying role or lower paying type job? Or my husband's philosophy is like, just hammer it out for another like 5 to 10 years and like, you know, we'll be in a good spot. And so I just don't know. And I've never talked to a CFP. I've kind of just kind of dabbled in our own little things thinking we're doing the right thing. And I'm like, okay, we need to just like figure out what we're doing. And it could be a good catalyst to say, hey, I can pivot and maybe do a less stressful job or something I've really been interested in for a while, or it's no, keep on what you're doing if you want to keep up like your lifestyle and
style.
Support your children and all of that. And you know, you're going to have to do it for a little bit more.
Yeah. It's an interesting spot to be because yeah, when you're approaching 40, you've been in your career for quite a bit of time. And so I think it seems like this happens quite often. I've like noticed amongst my friend group that around this age, people investigate maybe something different. Because if you've been in a high stress role for over a decade, it's a long time.
Yeah.
to like always be under the gun.
Yeah. And so, I'm currently okay in my current job, but I'm just not thrilled. So I'm like, okay, do I pivot to something similar, or is it now the time I can actually make a really serious change that I can do for the next, 20 years or whatever it may be. So I'm not sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about where you are with your finances currently. The first thing if just without knowing your numbers, but my first thing is probably we'd want to get through the daycare phase. I'm assuming since you're both working, the kids are in daycare. Okay. Yes. So we'll talk about that because that's obviously a huge expense.
Yes.
But let's go through the numbers and see where you are. And I would just say probably if you were going to pivot, we'll see what the numbers say, but it would probably be once your youngest is out of daycare.
Yeah. And we actually just paid for her last like full year of like intensive daycare. She'll be able to qualify for transitional kindergarten in California when she's four, which means no paying for like full day daycare, but we still have after school care, which is an additional expense. So, and it's been hard a little bit with our finances because we have this variable commission. We almost plan like in chunks of like, hey, I know I'm going to have like our property tax bill two times a year. We don't plan it out monthly. And then like childcare, it's like, okay, we get a credit and a discount if we pay up front in the beginning of the year. So we just kind of use a lump sum to do that. So I feel like I've been like, to my fault, like just keeping cash on hand in probably too many places to like account for some of those expenses if we don't get a bigger commission check for the year and things like that. So
yeah, that's the hard part about having variable income, especially because yours is very significant, right? Totally. Like if you hit your numbers, you almost can double your income, but it also is hard for planning purposes because you don't know if you're going to get it or not. So you don't want to count on it from a budget standpoint.
Yeah, exactly. So, I guess I can share childcare, which is just a little bit tricky because, so for my daughter, we just paid up front for childcare for 9 months. So it's $20,000.
That's a big number.
I know. It's so expensive. It's our last year.
It's your last year. And the other thing that I think is really interesting, I just had a conversation on, is if you or your husband had stepped out of the workplace for that time, it is so much harder to go back to a role at that level because you've been out of the workforce for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's harder to step in. So even though it's very expensive, it does allow you to maintain your career at that level, right? Without taking an income hit in your career. Instead, you're paying to maintain your career, right? By not stepping away.
So it's a big pill to swallow. And it's just being in the Bay Area, it's just so expensive. And we really love her daycare or her preschool. And so I was like, okay, we can do it for one more year.
And then that's your last big daycare expense, really.
That is our last big daycare expense. We will have next year, their summer program is separate.
Okay.
Who knows why? So it's about like $2,000 for like 7 weeks of the summer. That will pay in 2025.
So summer, and that's for both kids or just?
No, just one. So then my son is in the phase, or he's in kindergarten. So we pay for after school care for him, which is about $500 a month.
A month. Okay.
Yeah. In 2025, school year of 2025, my daughter will be in that. So then we'll be paying $1,000 both of them, is what we see. And then summer, that's for the school year. Summer, it's going to be a range of like summer camps and summer. So things there. So I'm thinking it'll probably for the summer, maybe like $1,500 to $2,500
a month.
For 2 months. Yeah. For two months. In the summer. Yeah.
So summer feels like a steal compared to the year, right?
I know. It's like, great. Let's do it. It's ridiculous.
All right. So those are the expenses we have that will be coming up once, because you've already prepaid for this the remaining year for your daughter. Okay. And then let's talk about let's start with what your net income is. We could talk about the variable comp, and then let's see what your savings debt soap worth is. And then we can kind of see if there's room for a pivot.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't feel like I don't track it like exactly by the numbers.
Okay.
But I do have a spreadsheet of like, okay, after taxes are taken out, roughly just on my base, what my take home is. And then we then have like insurance and FSA and some of those that are taken out afterwards. So just the monthly income for me is around like 7,000.
Okay.
And then for my husband, it's around 5 to 5,500 consistently. Okay.
And then in terms of health insurance, is that
that comes out of mine, and it's it's for the whole family, and it's $528 per month.
That's great for the whole family.
Yeah.
And then you're contributing to a 401k?
Yes. So we both are, we kind of, depending on our commission towards the end of the year, January, we pretty much change the, contribution to be higher. So yeah, so we both max out. Last year we were able to max out by March.
Perfect. Using bonuses.
Using our variable commission. This year I think it might take a little bit longer, but like I don't know what the right philosophy is, but I'm kind of like I'd rather get it done earlier in the year and then have my paychecks be a little bit higher consistently throughout the rest of the year. But we both are committed to maxing that out. We both don't currently have matches, which is unfortunate. So we're both at kind of smaller startup type companies. So it's max it out as soon as we can and then have it do what it needs to do.
Okay, perfect. So you're each going to put this year 23,000 in.
Okay. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think I put like, right now it's like taking like 50% out of my paycheck. So whatever it is to get to the limit is what we're trying to do.
I just ask because sometimes when I say you're maxing it out to the limit and they say, yes, I'm match, you know, I'm going to 6% or something. And I'm like, no, the IRS limit of 23,000.
Okay. And did that go up this year too? I feel like it changes every year.
It does incrementally. Some years it stays the same, but overall it usually goes up incrementally to kind of keep in line with cost of living adjustments. And that's pre-tax, I'm assuming, given that you're in a high cost of living area?
Yes.
High tax bracket? Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. That's good. That'll lower your taxable income, which will be helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So we both max out, which is great. Okay. So then from there, health insurance is taken care of. The FSA you do.
Yeah.
And 401k.
5,000. Yeah.
5,000. Okay. And so then we're working with approximately on a net basis, your take home is 7,000 a month and your husband's is 5,000. How do you all split? This is always different based on the couple. How do you all split the finances?
Yeah. So it's not perfect. So we still have our own checking and savings that we just have had forever. So when we got married, we ended up putting like a joint checking and savings through our credit union. And then we still though manage our own and then put in, it's not like necessarily an allocated percentage, but like we both just start putting in money in the joint to know, okay, the mortgage is coming up or this big expense is coming up. So that's how we do that. We also both have our own personal credit cards. We don't use them regularly, but for just some things where we're like, you know what, I'm going on a girls trip. I want to put it on my card. And just, it kind of feels like it's your own, even though at the end of the day, like it is our, we're sharing the money. And then we have a joint credit card for mostly all of the other like family expenses. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah. There's no, I am not a believer that there's a right or wrong. I think that you choose what is the most comfortable and works for you.
Yeah.
Dave Ramsey has very strong opinions on how it has to be. I think that everyone can choose their own path as long as it works for them, right? Everyone's relationship is different. Okay. So let's talk about, now that we know you have what you have approximately coming in, let's talk about what the expenses are. So you said you own a property, you own your home?
Yes. Okay. We own our home and we bought it in 2018.
Oh, good. So you got in before the craziness of COVID. Did you, and what's your interest rate?
So we refinanced twice. So right now I think we're at 2.5, which we did during COVID. So
amazing. That's a great, yeah. I mean, I don't know if we'll see those rates.
I know. And I was again. Upset having to refine. I was like, we're doing this again. Like, and, but I'm very, very happy we ended up doing that. So
yeah, that was, yeah. You nailed the timing. I don't know that anybody got lower than 2.5.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is your mortgage amount or carrying cost for the
Yes. So mortgage is around 3,000 a month. Okay. We pay 4,000 just as like, just a, let's just pay over.
Why? If, you have the lowest interest rate in history.
So
why
I don't know.
Paying more?
I don't, cause we can, I guess. And I don't know if it's like, I think there's this philosophy of me of like, have no debt, ever, just pay it down. I don't know. No,
no.
Keep it. Okay.
Keep it. I also have a 2.5% mortgage. I agree. I would love to have no debt, but from a leverage standpoint, it is, we're going to talk about this when we talk about pivoting, okay. But there's $1,000
that we can use for something
that you can use. They like, cause you're 2.5% is if, like a mortgage nobody has, right?
Yeah.
Very few people have. The people that refinanced at the right time got very, very lucky. Mm-hmm. Also, is it a 30 year or a 15 year?
It's 30.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think our philosophy was like, when we refinance, I always wanted to be like, hey, if one of us loses our job, like, mm-hmm. could someone still be able to cover the mortgage? And so I think mm-hmm. why we've been paying more, it's like, okay, well, we're both working, so we might as well mm-hmm. put more in because we can. But given my kind of circumstances now of maybe wanting to see what else is there, it probably makes sense not to be doing that.
Yeah, well, we can talk about it. So 30-year isn't as lean as a 15-year.
Yeah.
So you're reducing the interest overall that you're going to pay, but at 2.5%, I mean, you're not, right? I mean,
yeah.
They like gave you free money.
Yeah, basically.
Basically. Because like what you're going to pay in taxes to get the $1,000, right? If
yeah.
you think about what you had to make to net $1,000 to then put it on the mortgage, which is a 2.5% interest rate, if you could make 7.5% in the market, right? But there's nothing wrong with paying down. I mean, that's fine. But I think that's money we could use. And what okay. you actually would have to earn to net your $1,000 is a lot more.
Yeah. Okay.
Being in a high bracket. So yeah. that's like found money in terms of like wanting to make a career shift. That's,
yeah.
that's some money right there.
Okay.
But there's a lot of people that don't like having any debt. And I'm not opposed to having very lean mortgage debt and then using the money to further other financial goals.
Yeah. And that's what I wasn't even sure too of like, okay, if we have a good commission year, like I know some people who take that and just put it down towards their house and just continue mm-hmm. to kind of etch away at that at the mortgage. We haven't done that yet. It's just been this kind of monthly paying over on the monthly, but
Let me give you another way to think about it. You could take that money, invest it, and what it's earning, you could use to pay off the mortgage and you still have the principal amount, right?
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful.
That's another way to think about it. Just because when you like analyze like wealthier people, they like leverage, right? So they don't think about debt necessarily as a negative thing if they're using it to maximize other goals,
yeah.
right? So they lend against their investment accounts, they take out mortgages, right? And so we can use that money other ways and you're still getting a tax write-off, which is valuable in your tax bracket.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful
for the interest. Yeah. So we can dive into that a little bit more, but that's great to know. So you also have obviously for your income, you have a very reasonable housing cost, which is wonderful. And that also gives you a lot more flexibility with what job you have and what income, right? So if you said your mortgage was 10,000, it would be very hard to pivot.
Yes. Yeah. And we are never going to be in that position. And I think, okay. I mean, we're in a very old house and so we've had a lot of expenses come up. And I think we can get into this of why I've like hoarded cash because I just probably more than I could have put it somewhere else, but it's just like with this house, we don't know what's going to happen. So we've always having this buffer. Like right now we might have to replace our heating, which is $30,000. That is just,
houses are
very expensive. Yeah.
Yes. If you've listened to the podcast, I have a very old house.
Yeah,
we have a hard time together.
They're charming, but yeah. I mean, we just got our heating bill and it was $500 just to like heat the house. I mean, we're in California, so it's expensive, but just to even heat our home, I'm like, that could go towards like so many other things.
Big.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Okay, perfect. So housing, you're spending $4,000 because you're doing $1,000 prepayment of principal. You have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at 2.5%, which is a dream. And then what are some of your other monthly expenses.
Okay. So I don't do a good, I do an okay job, okay, like categorizing it. But like I said, that we have some of these like bigger expenses throughout the year that maybe we weren't planning. So it's hard to account them into like a monthly. But that's, I would say like on average, so groceries for a family of four, I'd say on average, we're about $700 a month.
Okay.
We do eat out. I would say that ranges from about $150 to $250 a month.
Okay. This all feels very low.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Sometimes if, well, and then I have like a Costco expense. So like some months we spend $500 at Costco, but then we don't go for like 3 months. So I just have on my spreadsheet, I have like a Costco line item, which I'm just looking at like through the year, it says we spend about $2,000 at Costco a year. So it's like a couple big
trips, yeah,
big trips for, you know, all sorts of things. So our actual biggest line item expense just in like day to day is Amazon, which I took Amazon off of my phone because I found myself just like, oh, freaking. I need, yes. And okay, and I will show you. So it says here, and like we have young kids, so it's like, hey, they need this, this. And so, but it says we spent $5,000 on Amazon this year, which feels like a lot.
Yeah. But I mean, it depends on what you're getting, because you can get grocery items on Amazon, right? Like, are you getting like...
Not really. I feel we're getting like, I mean, but it's just like, you know, I mean, we are doing some household items and like, you know, personal shampoo and things like that. But it's also like, hey, we're going on a trip with the kids. Like, we need all the stuff that they can do on like the airplane, or hey, Christmas is coming up. Like, it just, a goal of this year is just to cut back on
Amazon,
impulse Amazon purchases that...
Okay.
I could do without. We could do without, I feel like.
And then do you have cars?
Yes, our cars are paid off.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so I would though, like my car is 11 years old. So I don't know timing wise, but I would eventually like to have a new vehicle. I don't know if we would do car payment or just pay in cash. I don't know if you have a position on that.
I'm curious to see how much you have in cash.
Oh, okay. I'll tell you. But our, let's see, car payments, or no. So registration for cars for the year is about $500. Insurance is a little bit expensive for cars. Okay. So we do two payments through the year, $1,200.
Okay.
Every 6 months, I think. My husband has a more expensive car. Yeah.
So it seems like though you pay for your big expenses up front. So you also mentioned you with property. Is that not escrowed into your mortgage? You pay property separate?
Yeah, we pay property separate. And I don't know. I think we did that because we didn't want to pay, like, have it included in all the taxes and fees when we first did the mortgage. But yeah, so that is expensive for where we are. Let me find what we're paying in property. That's two payments a year at $6,700.
Okay, so those are big numbers.
Yeah, and those are ones that we just do, you know, at March and just do it in one lump sum.
Lump sum,
yeah. Okay.
And any other, besides the child care property tax, any other really big, and the car insurance, any other really big
lump sum payments? I mean, so we both have life insurance. Those are about $800 a year payment. It's actually, not that big, but.
What kind of life insurance?
So I have a 25-year plan that I got 2 years ago to get me to ride around 60 for $1.5 million.
And that's term?
Term, yeah.
Perfect. Okay, good.
And then my husband has a 20-year term for $1 million.
Perfect. Great.
Yeah, and that was a big goal. We hadn't done it, and so during COVID, we finally were like, we need to get this figured out, so...
Yeah, perfect. And terms the way, terms the way to go. What's the remaining mortgage amount?
$680.
Okay, perfect. So that's perfect, because if anything happens to either one of you, should you want to, not necessarily have to, but should you want to, you could get rid of the mortgage, still have money left over, help care for the kids, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's great. And it takes you to the point where the kids are now adults. And so the financial needs. So that's great.
Okay. Yeah. And I wasn't sure because we had expensive. We had it to about 60. So I'm like, oh, I don't know. Should we like do a little bit more to get to like 65? But I felt like that would give us enough where our kids are old enough that we would feel okay with what else we have to support.
Yeah. And so remember with term insurance, this isn't often advertised. Up until usually the last year, you could convert a portion of it to permanent if you wanted to.
Oh, okay.
So you have that optionality. I think the reason is they always want to be able to upsell you.
Yeah.
So they have that in there. So you could always just say, you know, in 23 years, I do feel like I have a need for $100,000 policy. So you would take the 1.5 down to 100, you would get a quote for it. It would be more expensive, obviously, but you could convert a portion of it. If you wouldn't convert 1.5, that would be astronomical. But there's that. And remember, you're still really young. So you could always say, I'm going to go and look for another policy should something change.
Yeah.
But that at least you have that. Okay. So that's good.
Okay. Yeah. That's helpful.
Okay. So would it be fair to say on a regular monthly basis, just ballparking, you probably need around 55,000-6,000 for your monthly expenses?
Yeah, that's what I think. So yeah, because we didn't factor in like PG&E sometimes or
cell phones,
Wi-Fi. Yeah, cable internet, you know, clothing.
So probably 6,000.
I'd say 6,000, 6,500 would be safe. Fair. And then we have like kid activities, which come in and out. So
taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should at least be simple. That's why for the last 3 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day with no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to take on my day. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. With AG1, I know I'm getting essential brain, gut, and immune health support with vitamins, probiotics, and nutrients from Whole Foods. I like to think of it as my nutritional insurance. I know I'm covering my nutritional bases from the very start of the day. If there's one product I had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why I've partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/future-rich. That's drinkag1.com/future-rich. Check it out.
So given that your monthly, not including the bonuses, just your base salaries is 12, you're spending like 50% of that.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more. Still being able, even if you spend all of your take home, your husband's really isn't being utilized for your monthly needs. And then you're using that variable comp to pay some of the bigger expenses. Daycare being, I mean, obviously
the
that
biggest.
Was the biggest. Property tax being second at, you know, and that has that been going up every year or has it been consistent?
It has been going up, but I'd say roughly around like that's what we've kind of allocated. So.
Yeah, 13,000, 14,000. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about where you are, if that's okay
I forgot one more thing. We do both I guess this one, yeah, but we do a lump sum in our IRAs. Every year too, so that's like 6,500.
What IRAs? Traditional?
Yes. Well, then we convert to a Roth. Sorry, we put it in the IRA first, and then it converts to the Roth.
And you immediately convert it,
like after like 48 hours.
Yeah. So you don't have any money currently in a traditional IRA, only in the Roth.
My husband does not. I have a little bit of like residual that I had never put into the Roth. So that's a question on what. What do I do with that? Because that was before I was doing the backdoor Roth conversion.
So the backdoor is tricky because to make it really clean, you should be converting the whole amount. There's differing opinions on like what to make sure it's like technically a two-step transaction. Like should you wait 30 days or 60 days or how long to convert? But the trick with that, so first the two things. You're not eligible to do a traditional IRA because of your income and because you have workplace plans, which most people don't know. Everyone thinks that you can always do a traditional IRA if there's only limitations on the Roth, which is inaccurate. There's restrictions on both traditional IRAs and on Roth IRAs. The second is when you do a non-deductible IRA and then convert, you have a couple of things to be wary of. One is the pro rata rule, which states that they're using a proportion of the amount that you're converting, which is why you don't want to have any other IRA assets. And then the other one, which I've never run into, but is written about, which is like the two-step doctrine, right? So like making sure you're showing that it's technically two steps. Most people, I've never had an issue with it. It doesn't mean that you couldn't have an issue with it. How much do you have in that residual traditional IRA? And that traditional IRA is non-deductible dollars or pre-tax dollars?
I think it's non-deductible.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
And it just got left behind?
Yeah. So I think, and I might need to ask, it's in like an account that it was like my mom's financial advisor. And so she's like, you need to open an IRA. So I was like, okay. And just did that. And then I think, I just don't know what happened to it. So there's 30K in there. So I don't know
that's
if I can.
That's not a little bit of money. And it's, are you sure it's not deductible? None of that is pre-tax?
I don't know. Okay. I need to confirm, but it's in the, cause I can see in the thing I have like our actual like Roth. And then there's this other account that is listed as IRA that it's just like sitting there.
Oh dear.
I have a problem.
You have a problem.
Okay.
Do you have an accountant? Who's been allowing you to do these non-deductible conversions without checking it?
Well, so I think, so every year we've done the like put in the IRA and then do the backdoor. And we've done that consistently probably for like 10 years or I forget how long.
At a DIY, like with no advisor on it. So yeah. No one said to you, hey, have you heard of the pro rata rule?
No one has said that. Not good.
I see this all the time.
Okay. That's,
Nobody knows about it.
Okay. I'll write that down. But okay. So we need to basically take that money and.
Who's doing your taxes?
Well, we have an accountant doing our taxes, but there's nothing. And maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but that's basically just an account that's sitting there with that amount of money in there. So.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, you have it. It's there.
Yeah.
And if it has mixed dollars amount in there, which it sounds like it probably does if you started this years ago, if it was pre-tax and post-tax, you have two types of monies in that vehicle. And that's the problem. If you have a pre-tax and post-tax in the same vehicle, and then outside of that, you have another IRA, the IRS does not say you have two accounts. You have one. They're looking at it as you're one person,
yeah.
Right? And so when you're doing that conversion, they will basically do, it's a proportion saying, okay, you're converting this amount, but then you have these other dollars. So we're attributing another portion over here, which means you could potentially have more tax than you're paying. So you're not paying any tax rate because you're converting it.
It's
in cash, you convert. But the thing is, technically you have another IRA that needed to pay tax if there was pre-tax dollars because they're mixed. I'm assuming you probably have pre-tax in that other one. You have to verify that.
Okay, I'll verify that.
If you have pre-tax, you probably ran yourself into the pro rata rule.
Okay.
This is why I don't like, I mean, some people really like it. I don't like the conversions unless you're doing it very cleanly, which is you have one account. You're doing this with and no other IRA monies.
Okay. Okay. So I'll look into that. And I think what might have happened, it was once I got, I've always had the Roth. And then once my income was too high to do a Roth, I think I started putting it in the IRA. And just
it's all non-deductible.
I don't know.
Okay. Check that.
Okay. I'll check that. But I think that is what happened. And then I was like, oh no, I should be like doing the back door. And so I used the IRA as like to put the money in first and then do it, even though that I never took out all of the funds in there into the Roth.
The way that it was described to me when I was learning about it is I don't like having accounts with mixed monies. And this is the reason why, is because something like this then causes a problem and people don't realize it's a problem. The description was, which I think is a great visual, when you mix the money types and then you want to make a change, it's like trying to take creamer out of milk.
Okay. Yeah, that's not
You've stirred it all together.
And I'd say we haven't, I mean, and like we've done our taxes through an accountant for the last like 5 or 6 years and nothing has come up as like an alarm. So I feel like we're doing it or not like breaking any rules. It's maybe just not set up in the right way that's beneficial.
I mean, so here's the thing. If the accountant doesn't know you have this other vehicle, he doesn't know that you've hit the pro rata, right? If he doesn't know that you have an IRA with mixed dollars, right?
Yeah.
That has pre-tax and post-tax, he doesn't know there's a problem because he doesn't have any tax document stating you have this other vehicle.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's something to look at.
Yeah. So that's something to look at. I mean, your best case scenario is it's all post and then that's not a problem.
I mean,
and it could be.
How do I find that out?
the statement should tell you, or you should be able to call and ask. It's okay. With an advisor, right?
Yeah.
So you just want to find out if it's all post-tax dollars or if it's a mix of pre-tax and post-tax. And this is what I will say. What some people like to diversify amongst advisors, and this is exactly why you shouldn't, because if she doesn't know, if she's managing this one account for you and she doesn't know you're doing non-deductible conversions over here, she can't give you the guidance that like, hey, there's this thing called the pro rata rule, because this hand doesn't know what this hand is doing. Yeah. The accountant doesn't know you have two accounts, so they can't advise you because they're not seeing everything either, because the accountant's only getting the tax documents and an IRA is not generating a tax document, right?
Yeah.
Because it's tax sheltered. So this is where like a very simple thing can get like a bit convoluted.
Yeah, no, which is kind of, I think like my financial life. It's like, oh, you need to like do this and save here and have this here and like done all of that. But I don't think I have a good understanding of like in long-term financial planning, like what some of the implications may be versus just like, yeah, just save here and do that. Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't hit it. I think this is the problem, in my opinion, over like the last 17 years that I've been in finance. There's so much stuff online and everybody is an expert and they're like, you definitely should be doing a non-deductible IRA and converting it. No, you shouldn't. Nor should you listen to some random person online who did it for themselves because it's right for them. Like my sister and I look identical. People think we're twins. We have completely different financial lives, yeah, and do completely different things. Like, when someone says it's right for you online does not actually mean it's right for you. And like, I just saw a video this morning. It says not financial advice. And then she explicitly says, you should do this. That sounds like financial advice. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds exactly like advice. And while her concept might have good intentions, what she said is not necessarily right for everybody. And she doesn't explain that there are any other options. And so I hear a lot, and I'm seeing it. I would say so far this year, we are 26 days into the year. I have found 4 individuals. We are doing no meetings this month, 0 meetings, 4 who have screwed this up.
Okay.
So I guess like the warning to the listeners is just because someone says you should do it online, like seek professional financial and tax advice first. And the only way to get good financial and tax advice is to completely disclose everything you're doing, right? So that's the hard part with people. If you have like 2 advisors, is one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. And they're maybe giving you advice on one component, not knowing there's implications with the other. Same thing with the accountant. The accountant is doing the best job, but if they don't know there's this other vehicle that has mixed monies, they don't know about the pro rata rule, right? They wouldn't talk about it. So ideally, you have all post-tax in there and then you are fine. Then that's okay.
Okay.
But those monies have been invested, right?
Yeah.
Which means if you go to convert it, you have to figure out what the you're going to be paying taxes on the gains, okay, right? Because
Okay. I will follow up there and see. So best case it is
Post-tax.
All post-tax. And then we'll be, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then gains. And then you can determine what you want to do. But from the IRS's standpoint, and I'm not a tax professional, but the way the IRS views it is one IRA. They don't differentiate that you have 2 different accounts with 2 different people. When you're looking at the pro rata rule, they aggregate everything.
So I guess my question though, then, is because we said like your traditional IRA and then a Roth, those, they don't view those as separate.
All of your IRAs get aggregated together.
Oh, got it. Okay.
To determine the pro rata rule,
got
right?
It.
To determine what the implications are. They're going to look at all IRAs. That includes simple IRAs. Anything with IRA is going to be included. And so that's why it gets messy when you have 2.
Yeah.
Right. And then the problem comes down to whether there are post-tax and the pre-tax mixed together. That's the problem. If everything is post-tax, you won't have a problem. But the not ideal for you is if you want to convert that, you have to figure out the gains and you're going to be paying tax. So it is a taxable transaction for you for that.
Yeah.
Where if it was done before the money was invested, so you put in $6,500 and convert $6,500, there is not a tax ramification there in theory. If it went from $6,500, or let's just say you started with 20, now it's 30. To convert it, you're converting at 30. So in theory, you'd have $10,000 of gain that you'd be paying on. And the other thing is then people say, do you want to withhold to pay the taxes? You don't withhold on doing a conversion because then it's a distribution and you're under 59 and a half and then you get hit with a 10% penalty.
Got it. Okay. Okay. So I think, okay, that I will get some clarification there.
Get some clarification on that one.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry. This is the problem. I feel like it's like all over, like everyone tells everybody what to do and they don't know what the rules are.
Yeah.
They don't know what the aggregation rule of, AKA the pro rata rule is. They don't know about like the under 59 and a half if you withhold, and that's fine because they don't do this for a living. They just think it's a good idea for themselves, and then they go out into the world on a TikTok video and tell everybody they should do it too.
Yeah. Which I don't think that's where we got our advice from, but it was more okay. Just like, okay, here, this is where you need to kind of move some of your money.
Okay, so you're going to check on that.
Yes, I will check on that. But I will say, I mean, I think over the last minus this, like, I read that just has money in it. We have been doing the like, okay, 6,500, then convert it to the Roth, and that's been clean. So it's more on just what's going to happen with this.
It's when you have mixed. Yeah. It's when you have multiple IRAs and mixed dollars.
Yeah.
So like the way I like to think about it is you always want to keep your money types together.
Okay.
Right. I don't like to mix them, like your pre-tax stay together, post-tax, and then your Roth. Cause there's three money types, right? Those are the three money types.
Yeah.
Also, what I would be curious is if your workplace plan, because it's a startup, allows for non-deductible dollars in your workplace plan.
I don't think so.
It does. And what about your husband's?
No.
Is he allowed to do non-deductible?
I don't think so. Yeah. We don't even have we don't have Roth options through our workplace. Okay. So we've just been doing our own independent in our brokerage accounts and then the 401k.
Okay. Perfect. So what do we have total for, why don't we go through like emergency fund, 401k values, Roth.
Yeah. Okay. So 401k. So my husband has 210.
Great.
And I have 664.
Amazing.
Is that good? I don't know. I feel like
great.
Okay. No, I don't know. And so I'm like, is someone going to pat me on the back? Did I do a good job? I've been trying to max it out since like I started my career around 25. So I feel like
I think that's fantastic.
Okay. So we have that. We have a bunch of mix of like investments accounts, CDs, savings. Like I'm kicking myself for like, I just get so nervous of like something's going to happen that I just need like cash under the pillow, which I know is not. We could have made so much money if we did something with it over the last couple of years, but we didn't. So,
But that's okay. You've also been in a very high expense period of your life with young children.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's like literally a segment of your life that's very, very expensive. And it's when you have young children.
Yeah. So we have, we have 140K in two separate high yield savings, but CDs. They're at like 5%, right? So we're in like a 12-month term with them. Just in cash savings, we have another 65K.
Okay. So in between CDs and cash, you have over 200,000, 205.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay.
And we have, so I worked at a tech company for a while that had employee stock purchase plans. And so I never touched that. So there's about 650K just in that one company stock in employee stock purchase that I've left the company, but that's still there.
Okay. And you're
fully vested, converted it or taken out of the paycheck. So that's just sitting there, which.
And it's 650 in one company?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a great company. Yeah. And so that's why I don't know, like I don't work for them anymore. So it's like, I have that risk away, but it's also a lot in one.
Yeah. And what's your tax ramification? Are there any, did you already, like, usually there's a basis from when you purchase to the value currently?
I think we've done that.
Okay.
I can confirm, but I feel like when it was converting in my paychecks of like employee stock purchase plan, buy at 10% less, like that all already happened. And then it's just like in the,
but it's grown since, right?
Yes.
So that you have taxes on.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. So if you bought it, you got a discount on it.
Yeah.
You bought it, let's just say, which is just round numbers. Yeah. You bought it at $10. It's now gone to 15. You still will have tax on that gain.
Okay. And there'll probably be a lot of tax on that gain. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cause you had it for a while, which is fantastic. There are ways to unwind what is called a concentrated stock position, which is what this would be.
Okay.
Those are called, I believe, exchange funds. So you go in and they unwind it to try and help with the tax mitigation put you in a more diversified portfolio.
Got it. Okay. And it's been a tough, like, I just don't know, because like the stock continues to go up and up and
up.
And so I'm like, do we just hold on to it till whenever? Like, I that's one where I'm like, okay, I don't know what we should do with that.
The hard part with giving someone advice on that or talking about it is what will happen is anybody with a designation in this profession will say that is too much in one company.
Yeah.
Because if you walked into someone's office, this is just to give you like the flip side of it, and said, I just hit the lottery, I won $1 million after taxes, I would have $650,000 to invest, right? Because they lose probably more. You probably have $600,000. I have $600,000. What should I do? And if the professional on the other side of the table said to you, I have this one great stock, we're going to put it all in there and it's going to do wonderfully. And you'd be like, no, I don't want to put all my money with one company.
Yeah.
So, but the hard part is when you work for the company and it's done really, really well, the downside is diversification doesn't always yield greater results. It mitigates risk, but mitigating risk sometimes isn't fun, because then you look at the stock and you're like, well, I would have made more money if I didn't mitigate the risk.
Yeah.
It's only if the company goes down do you feel good about this decision, right? Like, and we don't know if that will happen. Could it happen? Yes. Could it continue to run up for another 10 years? Absolutely. From a risk standpoint, which is what most professionals help mitigate, is it's too much. While you can, people do keep concentrated positions. You just have to be aware of the downsides. Yeah. And so I always get nervous with that when you've worked for the company, because I'd hate to be like, you should mitigate your risk, and then it doubles again, and you're like, well, that was a bad decision.
Yeah.
But you just don't know what will happen in the future.
Yes. And I am very risk averse. So I've known for a while that, like, you shouldn't have all these, like, all majority of your wealth in one company. But then, like, that was, like, a couple years ago, and it's continued to go up. So I just didn't know kind of, like, what are some of the options, because I would like to still keep a position in there.
So one like reasonable, and I think it's like, I always like to compromise, even just like with myself, like, why don't you could always unwind some of it and keep some of it. And if you believe in it, you can keep more in it. That's fine. And there's some other ways to mitigate your downside, which I won't get into because they're a little complicated for the purpose of this conversation.
Yeah.
But you could always mitigate your risk by taking some of it off the table. Just like if this is like, to me, this feels very reasonable. If I hate to use the analogy of gambling, but if you went to a casino with 100,000 and turned it into two, what I would do is put the other 100 that I won and then put it in my pocket and be happy. And then just keep playing with the 100 that I originally started, but at least I put some of my gains in my pocket. That's how I would do it.
Okay.
But I do think some people will tell you definitively what to do. I think with that, if it's a good company, you work there, you like it, I think there's probably some arena of where you keep a good portion of it and then mitigate your risk with the other portion. Like, take some of your gains off the table. Like, every few years you say, I'm going to take gains out of this position. And if the stock continues to run up, I know I'm not going to make as much, but should the stock go down, I'm going to feel better because I took some of it off the table.
Yeah. I know. I feel like you always hear those stories of like, oh, an admin invested like 100 shares like 30 years ago and they never touched it. And now they're like, you know, have millions of dollars. So I'm like, oh, maybe that would happen.
Maybe.
But
you're pretty close.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, we'll put that on the side.
Yeah. So we have a few other ones. Okay. So that's that individual stock. I have like an individual brokerage account for about 100K. We have about 60K in our 529s for both kids.
Great. And did you hear that now, starting in 2024, they can be converted to Roth if they're not used for education?
Yes. Is there only a 30K, only for 30K?
35.
Okay, great. And that was a question.
That'll probably change. I would think that would go up over the years.
Okay, because my husband and I have talked about, should we do like a brokerage, I forget what it's called, but like a brokerage account for them. But I feel like the 529, we don't have a tax savings in California with it, but it's just like, it feels safe and
tax
like
tax shelter. Yeah. You're not getting a 1099 on it. So that's great.
Yeah. So I think we're going to continue with those. And then, we haven't decided yet on like, do we want to fully fund their education, like state school, private school? Do they want to go to college? Mm-hmm. Like, who knows? But knowing that that can transfer or use for like generations if needed, or go into the Roth. Like I feel like,
yeah, you can do between siblings, between cousins. It can go to your child's child, which people don't realize.
Yeah.
So I really like the 529. I also like that there's no tax drag on it while it's growing. And I do believe that it has a ton of optionality. It also gives you control because obviously 18-year-olds don't always make the best decisions.
Yeah.
So it allows you to stay in control of what's happening as well.
Okay. Yeah. So we keep in those, they get birthday money and things like that. And we just put it in. And then depending on our variable commissions, like I like to start the year of just putting like a chunk in there versus like a monthly, but that, you know, that may change. So, okay. That's the 529. The Roths, between the two of us in the Roth, there's, what is that? 250.
Great.
And then we have one more, just like my E-Trade account that I've played with. So I have 175K in there.
Oh, that's a big Dabble account.
I don't know. But in there is a mix of Vanguard funds and like that. And then maybe I've done a couple little stock picks, but that's too risky for me. So that's just in there to see what happens.
See what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the only debt, if I'm correct, is the mortgage.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So no, we paid off student loans, no car payment. Okay. So yeah, the is the mortgage. Yes.
I don't see any issue with you switching career paths.
Really?
Well, because you're not living on your income. You're saving it all, which is fantastic. And I actually don't think you have too much in cash. You have 205. Yes, fair, a lot. But as you said, right now, this is a very expensive part of life that you're in. And when anything goes wrong in an old house, it is never, there's no such thing as a $300 expense. I've never had one. I doubt you've ever had one. It's always going to be thousands of dollars. You also then have cash. You could buy a car. Interest rates are going to be significantly higher than what you're currently yielding, right? So it's probably going to be 6-7% to get a car loan. You could if you want it to, but there's like a little bit of a, you want it, like I like to buy the car, especially if you're going to drive it for 10 years. I wouldn't have the loan, buy it, be done with it, don't have the car payment, especially if you're going to switch careers. And then it seems like you could probably get a job because we would stop the, you know, $1,000 a month, which is really more like $1,500 probably when you roll it back up. So it seems like the only thing I have to factor in here is the property tax, because that's a pretty big bill. If you came in around your base, right, without your bonus, you would probably be fine.
Still be comfortable. Yeah, and I think the other thing that concerns, I mean, like, I've heard you talk about Social Security and like what that means. And I just get like, you know, I have friends that work in public service and they're like, oh, we're going to have our pensions. And I'm like, oh, that's great. So I'm like, I'm just nervous for like, you know, is there going to be enough to like sustain us through longevity?
I think that's a real, real concern. But given the fact that you have well over $1 million saved and you have not hit 40, you have no debt, you have a very lean mortgage, and you have very low cost of living. The first thing I noticed, right? So I would say you want to stay in this job until you're youngest, just to get you a little farther away from the very expensive years, you know, when they're really little. So maybe like two more years, your daughter
is in school.
I just think that would give you more peace of mind. Also being risk averse, it gives you another 2 years to save, right? And then you could start looking for a job. I think that if you came in around where your base is with like a little bit of bonus, but I don't think you need to have a bonus that's doubling it. I think you would be more than comfortable. You would probably, with a lower salary amount, want to start saving for the property tax monthly.
Okay.
Just to escrow it yourself. That's what I would do if I was in your position.
Okay.
And you could practice doing that now on a lower, like I would try for the next 2 years, which you're already really doing, but maybe escrowing the property tax with your 7,000 because you're not living on it, right? Or a month or two, just to say like, okay, actually I would be comfortable where we're not having as much to save every month, but because I think there's a lot to be said for like liking your job as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You've done a really good job saving. And I think there has to be a happy medium between saving for the future, but also enjoying today. Like putting your head down and sucking it up for 10 years is a long time to suck it up.
Yeah. And
just to have more money.
Yeah. And I, you know, before I worked in tech, I got a master's in higher education administration to work with students and colleges. And I really liked that. And then the first recession happened, there's no jobs. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to try this tech thing. And even my mom's like, just try it for a little while, just save. And then maybe later you can like go back to what you wanted to do originally. And so now I'm kind of at that point of like, okay, did I do enough or can I, you know, let it go a little bit longer and kind of see what happens. So I think I'm always looking for like reassurance, but I don't know.
Yeah. It's hard because, right. And that's the thing that's like really tricky about this is like everyone's finances are the same, but what I like to see for people in order to succeed long-term is housing costs is usually the highest cost for people. And that's what really screws you up. Cause if you're spending 7,000 extra compared to you on housing, well, the only way to take a lower paying job is to probably change houses, right? It's the only way to do that. Yeah. So you don't have to do that. You have a really low cost of living relative to your income, which has allowed you to save a ton of money, which gets you ahead of the game, right? Because now you have compounding of interest on your side. So let's just add up. So between, if we're thinking of it as joint money, so your husband has 210, you have 664. I'm not even going to include the cash because it's not growing as much. And we're going to use that to offset some of the bigger expenses.
Yeah.
But then with the individual brokerage account and then with the Roths and then with the very surprisingly large play account at E-Trade, then the other little IRA that we don't know what's in there yet, that comes to just over $1.4 million, not including the 529s, because those are really for your kids. Yeah. Then if we add in this very large stock position, which could, you know, fluctuate, you know, plus 650 there, you're at close to $2.1 million.
Okay.
So let's just say we use two as the number. You have 2 million, right? Just to be conservative. And you're 38. Almost 39?
Almost
39. 38. Okay. Let's use 39 to be more conservative. All of that is invested, right? Because we didn't count the cash and CDs and stuff because we're going to use that, we'll say. So then at 49, if you do nothing else, we just keep it invested and we get an average compounding return of 7.2%. That's 4 million at 49. And then at 59, that should be 8 million using 7.2% compounding growth, which is conservative. I saw a terrible TikTok this morning that used 20% growth.
What?
I was
That'd be great.
What? I was like, that would be wonderful. But like, I think 7.2 is a little high. Like some people use six, but it's a, just a good for, could be higher, could be lower, somewhere in the middle. So then at 59, it's 8 million. You don't have a high cost of living. You didn't give me any line items that I see all the time that are like, I have to have this and it's $1,000 a month. Like you were like food, Amazon is your big expense. So that's, it really isn't egregious given your income.
Okay.
And 8 million, if you were, that's a 59, which is quite young, I think. People also say like, you shouldn't have to work to your 70, but what if you like your job? It's not bad for your brain to be working if you enjoy what you're doing. You don't have to be working full time.
Yeah, I would want not want to, I think, and then healthcare, that's like the other thing that
Healthcare is expensive. Yeah. Healthcare will always be expensive, unfortunately, most likely. But if you had 8 million and it shot off 4%, which is conservative, that would generate 320,000 a year.
Oh, wow. And that's, I would say I wouldn't, I mean, between my husband and I too. So that's more than enough. Yeah.
So I think you're fine if you want it to pivot. If I were you and I were in your shoes, I would do it once the kids were slightly older, just because you have less of those big costs for summer school, aftercare programs, and it gives you a little bit more time, in my mind, to get as much money saved by 40, and then you're just going to let it grow.
Okay. Okay.
That's what I would do.
That feels
helpful. I think you've done a great job. I think Fidelity came out, I think it was Fidelity came out with, or one of the big mutual fund companies came out with, like, how much you should save by, like, a certain age. And I think it was, like, one or one and a half or two times at 40. So you're like well beyond that. So. Yeah.
And I know, I mean, it's hard being in the Bay Area and tech and like seeing all this stuff. So we've tried to like not get in that, like keep up with the Joneses mindset.
Lifestyle creep.
Right. Yep. So it's real. And even, you know, maybe still like to, you know, vacation and do those things. But like, I feel like I've just been really mindful to try to just like keep within what we
feel comfortable with. Well, it's all about your priorities. Like, so if your priority, which it sounds like it is to not have a lot of debt, to have a comfortable, non-stressful financial life and to have the optionality to change careers to a lower paying career to do something you enjoy more, you've set yourself up for that.
Okay.
Now, there are other people that would say, I really like to have all this money. I want to buy a second home. I want to have $25,000 a year for vacation. That's a different goal, right?
Yeah.
And like you would need to keep your job to achieve those things. But you have a very reasonable cost of living, especially in a high cost of living area.
Yeah.
So I think that from what you're showing me with what you have saved, you've aligned to be able to take a step back income wise.
Great. Okay. That feels helpful. I needed some reassurance. But like I said, a couple years out,
you could technically, if you were absolutely miserable, do it today. I just think based on what you've said about being risk averse, I think you would feel more comfortable when we got your second child a little farther along. But I think you're in a very good spot at this time. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great. I'll say I started listening to a couple personal finance podcasts, and I was like, I couldn't really find what I want. So I went on Reddit and you were recommended. And so I some random Redditor, like Rhett was like, oh, I really like Barbara Gentry's podcast. So I was like, oh, and I found you and then I like listened to everything in like a couple months. And then I was like, you know what? I think I want to go on this show. That's why I came.
Well, amazing.
Yeah,
this was great. No, I think you've done a great job. And the only homework to do is just find out if you have pre and post tax in that IRA. If it's all post tax, you're good. If it's pre tax,
I'm gonna work good. Yeah.
I would just let your accountant know.
Okay. No, that's I don't want the IRS coming for me if I did something wrong. So
time for our disclaimer. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance references are historical and do not guarantee future results. Make sure that you consult with your own legal, tax, and/or financial advisor before making any decisions.